Salman Rushdie, 2 years, 8 months, and 28 nights. 2015. A colossal fragmentation of reality occurred in the 20th century, Salman Rushdie has said, and his novels enact and display that fragmentation with terror and glee. His new novel, 2 years, 8 months, and 28 nights, assures us that reality has been crumbling more colossally than ever lately and is about to come completely unglued. An even worse storm than any last winter will be followed by eschatological lightning strikes and local failures of gravity as the dark ifrits begin to take advantage of the weakening of the fabric of the everyday. The cumbrous title transcribes a certain number of days into years and months, but not the 4 weeks that should complete it, because the word nights is needed to suggest the original 1001. Rushdie is our Scheherazade, inexhaustibly enfolding story within story and unfolding tale after tale, with such irrepressible delight in doing so that it comes as a shock to remember that, like her, he has lived the life of a storyteller in immediate peril. Scheherazade told her 1001 tales to put off a stupid, cruel threat of death. He brought the threat upon himself by telling an unwelcome tale. So far, like her, he has succeeded in escaping. May he continue to do so. At the idea of trying to summarize the plot, I shriek and fall back fainting upon my seraglio couch. Rushdie has a fractal imagination. Plot buds from plot, endlessly. There are at least 101 stories and sub-stories, and nearly as many characters. All you need to know is that they're mostly highly entertaining, amusing, and, but I won't say ingenious, because a good many of the characters are, in fact, genies. Genies in English, jinn in their own language. The dilapidation of reality has affected the wall between our world and Peristan, the world of the jinn, leaving slots and slits through which they can slip. Their existence in Peristan is one of almost ceaseless sexual intercourse in surroundings of total luxury. Still, some of them, finding this as boring as some of us might, have always liked to sneak over here to entertain themselves by meddling with our little mortal lives. The male jinn are creatures of flame, the jinn-ya of smoke. They have great powers of magic, not so great powers of intellect. Willful, impulsive, and unwise, one of them gets trapped over here every now and then, imprisoned by a spell in a bottle or a lamp. We haven't seen any jinn for a while, because their passages into our world were sealed up about 1,000 years ago, not long after the greatest jinnia princess, Dunia, had a love affair with the philosopher Ibn Rushd in Andalusia. The outcome was a slew of descendants distinguished by their lobeless ears and the trace in them of fairy blood, for that's what Peristan is in English, fairyland. The main plot, the outermost Chinese box, is constructed around a philosophical feud between the rationalist Ibn Rushd and the pious Ghazali of Iran, who placed the power of God above all earthly causes and effects. Ibn Rushd tried to reconcile reason and humane morality with God and faith, a kindly God and an unfanatic faith. He challenged Ghazali. His reward was disgrace and exile. I met Salman Rushdie many years ago, long before the fatwa, but I can't remember if he has lobes to his ears. In any case, certain parallels are clear. This book is a fantasy, a fairy tale, and a brilliant reflection of and a serious meditation on the choices and agonies of our life in this world. The choices are presented simplistically, comic book style, as absolute good and evil. The agonies are presented, disaster movie style, as catastrophes so awful that readers who don't want to think about them can shrug them off. Rushdie is a generous, good-natured writer who'd rather woo and seduce his readers than reduce the truth to gall and brimstone and make them swallow it. All the same, the frontispiece of the book is the Goya engraving that stands at the very entrance of the modern age. The sleep of reason engenders monsters. The monsters here engendered, however playfully imagined, are not imaginary. The strongest male figure among the many in this book is Mr. Geronimo, a gardener. Physically and emotionally, he's a vivid character, likable for his strength and modesty and his homesickness for the city of his childhood, Bombay, which to him will never be Mumbai. There are strong women in the book, a mayor, a lady philosopher, but they're pretty much cartoons. The novel's heroine and protagonist is female, which I think is a first for Rushdie, and I wished I didn't have a problem with her. It's not that she isn't human. You can't ask a fairy princess to be anything but what she is, but you can ask her not to think like a man. Bearing children by the litter, 7 to 19 at a time, is certainly a practical engineering approach to leaving a large number of offspring, but not one many women would choose. We don't see Dunia nursing her babies. It would be interesting to know how she did it, or anything of her certainly busy motherhood. When she returns to Earth after 1,000 years, it is to defend her children, but this means her remote descendants, a scattered group of earlobeless people whom she calls the Duniyat, asserting her authorship of a lineage. The usual name for this authorship is paternity. Its importance to men among the Mediterranean and Arabic peoples is very great. More generally, while women are likely to value their actual children and their status as mother over any abstract idea of lineage, men often consider their children, particularly sons, most valuable as maintaining the paternal bloodline. This gender difference may reflect biological imperatives. Male mammals being motivated to reproduce their genes, females to nurture the gene bearers. Dunia's a mammal, all right, but her loving heart and her numerous litters can't keep me from suspecting that, like so many other kick-ass weapon-wielding warrior women, she's a man in drag. In the terrible period called the Strangeness, beginning about right now, the Dark Jinn, the great Ifrits, will try to destroy humanity with all their arts of magic and unreason, and Dunia will summon her Duniyat with their drop of Jinn blood to defend us with the same arts. So we have the war between good and evil, with supervillains and superheroes. My favorite is Nataraj Hero, a.k.a. Jimmy Kapoor of Queens, New York, conducted according to the best precedents. According to precedent, and a bit anticlimactically, the good guys win. The last of the mighty dark ones, Zumurrud, is imprisoned in a blue glass bottle by the lady philosopher. The rest of the jinn retire to Peristan, and Dunia closes the passages between the worlds in a final act of supermaternal self-sacrifice. Towards the end of the book, we find that our descendants of the next millennium have abandoned conflict as a way of life. They peacefully cultivate their gardens rather than their bigotries and hatreds, having found that, in the end, rage, no matter how profoundly justified, destroys the enraged. But, of course, there has to be a but. Contemporary sophistication declares that peace is boring. Moderation is blah. Happy is sappy. Defying sophistry, Rushdie imagines a contented people, but only by depriving them of dreams. No visions, no nightmares. Their sleep is empty darkness. The implication is that our human gift of imagining can't exist without the hatred anger, and aggressiveness that lead to such human behaviors as warfare, conscious cruelty, and deliberate destruction. To imply that only the dark jinn in us can give us dreams and visions may be one way of admitting the essential balance between the creative and the destructive within us. But it's also, I think, a capitulation to the idea, so powerful in 20th century literature, that the slow processes of creation are less interesting, less real, than the catastrophic dramas of destruction. And this leaves us right back where we are now. If cultivating our garden stultifies our minds, if using reason prevents our seeing visions, if compassion enfeebles us, what then? Back to conflict as our default solution? Cultivate hatred, anger, violence, reinstate the priests, politicians, and war makers, and finish destroying the earth? I wish we could abandon this false alternative, which neglects the possibility of more imaginative uses of both the light and the darkness in us. So the very end of the story was, to me, a letdown. But it may not be so to others. And I like to think how many readers are going to admire the courage of this book, revel in its fierce colors, its boisterousness, humor, and tremendous pizzazz, and take delight in its generosity of spirit.